BCFM 93.2 is a charity run entirely by volunteers. That means we are not for profit, so we can put you, the people of Bristol, first. BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
In view of the law of natural selection, it was agreed that a nation or world of people who will not use their intelligence are no better than animals who do not have intelligence. Such people are beasts of burden and stakes on the table by choice and consent. Always have been and always will be.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. What does it say about a country when the consequences of being late for a job interview at the job centre are greater than illegally invading a country and killing millions of innocent people? The Iraq war criminals, are they also the murderers of MOD weapons inspector Dr. David Kelly? No justice, even with Chilcot, and also a massive blast in Baghdad kills 250 innocent people to remind us what a disaster the invasion of Iraq really was and how the United Nations was right not to give Britain and America a resolution to start the war. Also, yesterday evening in Dallas, snipers kill 5 police officers and injure 6 more at an otherwise peaceful Black People Matter rally. Black Lives Matter, sorry. Plus, an exclusive interview with one of the most important intelligence insiders in the run-up to the illegal invasion of Iraq. That's Susan Lindauer. She suffered a year in jail to keep her out of the way and was threatened with being drugged into a permanent zombie just for telling the truth. And it was Colin Powell who was behind it. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspot. We'll have some clips from Susan Lindauer tonight, but you can hear the full interview on our sister show Dialect, which is back at noon every Tuesday here on BCFM 93.2. Well, we'll be talking a lot about Chilcot, Martin, but let's start with last night's horrendous attack over in Dallas, Texas. Of course, the venue in 1963 for the assassination of the US President John F. Kennedy.
Indeed. Obviously, it's very hard at this immediately after the event to follow all the detail of it. I think the fear has to be that this is part of a Gladio-style psychological warfare strategy in the US, similar to what was NATO carried out in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s, where social division is encouraged through the encouragement of left and right wing violence, because of in order to allow the state to have more powers of control and intimidation. I'm not saying that is what's happened, but the use of snipers during mass demonstrations is very suspicious, because we saw that in Kiev. In the Maidan Square, we saw it in Tunisia, we've seen it in Venezuela, we've seen it in Egypt, as part of a strategy of tension. And of course, you very rarely saw such things taking place in Northern Ireland over the years, because the IRA realised that you can't use snipers while you've got a mass demonstration on.
Just looking at the news reports on this, we've had a so-called confession, which has been delivered to the police by one of these snipers, and there were certainly at least two, because we heard there were bullets were coming from different directions. Mm. So as people, the police officers and members of the demonstration tried to hide behind one sort of barrier, then they were opened fire from a different direction. So we know that there were at least two snipers. And the only thing what bothers me is we've got a confession from the police, but then the police blew up the guy that had made the confession. I mean, this isn't really justice. This almost seems like rolling things out through the press rather than actually going to taught about events?
Well, if we go back to what happened in Maidan Square in Kiev, I think the evidence is overwhelming now that the snipers were actually linked to the new regime. They were Pravi sector snipers who had been trained at the Warsaw Police Academy by NATO special forces, possibly including the British. They then shot both police officers and demonstrators in order to create chaos. We saw similar things happen in Thailand during the Red Shirts uprising against the regime there, and it's part of a particularly NATO intelligence services Psywar strategy. You have mass demonstrations, people in those demonstrations open fire on the police, this is what happened in Syria, and then the police overreact by opening fire on the demonstrators. Thus you set off a cycle of violence which then allows you to either overthrow the regime that's in power or to bring in a police state by the back door. Now I'm not saying that that is what's happened in Dallas, we haven't got enough detail yet, but we certainly know that that's the sort of thing that's been going on. A lot of the incidents in the United States, to my mind, are fabricated false flag incidents, and this may well be another one.
This guy, of course, who's been blown up by the police, was actually only a suspect, so we don't really have hard evidence that he was one of the shooters.
Well, what you do in these things is you get somebody who's slightly unhinged, you persuade them to do something crazy, then you kill them so that they can never be put on trial, and who put them up to it to come out, and you create an atmosphere of chaos and tension. So what happened in Italy was the far right and the far left were both infiltrated by the intelligence services, and their violence was being used in order to steer the state in a certain direction, and they had no qualms about killing civilian police officers as part of the strategy of tension. And this has all been uncovered by police investigations in Italy, by the judiciary over there. It's not disputable, and it's the sort of thing that Labour MPs ought to know about, but they don't. And so when things like this happen, everybody throws up their arms in horror and goes, gosh, isn't this terrible? One side of the aisle is saying the police are killing black people, isn't it awful? The other side is saying, look, police officers are being shot, isn't it awful? And the point is that the whole thing is quite possibly being orchestrated. Well, I'm not sure that it's being orchestrated, we haven't got enough information yet, but in other circumstances these kind of incidents are being orchestrated, and they've been orchestrating them for decades now.
Well, what we're hearing at the moment from WFAA in Dallas is that 14 people in total were shot, two were civilians. The police department identified the suspect as Micah X. Johnson of Mesquite, which is just on the east side of Dallas. I know that because I've looked quite a lot at the JFK assassination, and it was in Mesquite where James Files stayed, who certainly looks like the guy that was the main shooter of JFK back in those times. And you can hear the excerpts from interviews with James Files, the hitman for the mafia, who were from Chicago, who came down to kill John F. Kennedy, essentially with the backup of the FBI, the CIA, and Lyndon Johnson, the vice president. That's certainly the way it looks in our investigations, and we've done a whole investigation into this exactly 50 years after that on this show a few years ago. But Martin, there's more and more people being reported as being shot all the time, and also civilians being shot, so this doesn't look as if it's something which has just been aimed at the police.
Well, as I say, what happened in the Maidan Square, which makes it very suspicious, is both police officers and demonstrators were being shot from the same from the same location, which was under the control of Pravi sector. What we saw happening in Syria is you've got peaceful demonstrations against the regime, and then jihadi terrorists opening fire on the police, and then the police opening fire on demonstrators and creating bloodshed. Now, these kind of situations are frequently manipulated. Mass demonstrations plus snipers, as I said, you very rarely saw that in Northern Ireland because the IRA were very careful
to
avoid it.
What the media are saying is the suspect said he wanted to kill white people. Well, that isn't actually from his own mouth, and this has been produced as a fact, whereas actually it's only an allegation that's coming from the police.
Well, when somebody who's dead apparently makes an inflammatory statement like that, my alarm bells start ringing. What sense does it make to make such a statement? And of course, if it was a lone nutcase doing that, okay, but we've got more than one sniper, we've already established that. So there's certainly an organisation behind this. The question is, whose organisation? What organisation? And most of the so-called jihadi terrorists in the United States have been people set up by the FBI. Most of the far-right terrorists have also been people set up by the FBI, and no doubt most of these kind of what you might call pseudo Black Panther terrorists are also being set up by the FBI, and they've got a track record of doing this going back to the 1960s, and COINTELPRO, which everybody who reads anything knows is what they were getting up to. But no doubt there will be the usual idiots running around in the mainstream media painting broad brush cultural criticisms of this, that and the other going on, the police violence,
etc. What you seem to be saying is that there's an attempt to kind of almost get a race war going in the United States between poor black people and poor white people. What would be the purpose of something like that?
So that the rich white people at the top of the pile can carry on raking in their dough. It's as simple as that, really. It's fundamental. I mean, one of the main motives behind the 9/11 attacks looks like an insurance fraud by those who had just bought the World Trade Center, had been privatized 6 weeks before, and the consortium that bought it got a massive payout when the buildings so mysteriously came down in one go through a terrorist attack, which they just happened to have insured themselves against, which put a lot of money in their pockets.
The biennial NATO summit, once every 2 years this happens. It was in Newport, I think, wasn't it, a couple of years ago?
Yeah.
It's just opened in Poland. The US says it will deploy 1,000 extra troops to Poland on the same day that Obama has given a speech about this attack over in Dallas.
Well, I just cannot see the point. I mean, I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to intimidate the Russians and prevent the Western Europeans, and that includes the East Europeans, from having a sensible, constructive economic relationship with the Russian Federation. That's what this is about. They want the West Europeans, including Eastern Europe, to sign up to the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and they want to end all economic linkages, particularly between Germany and the Russian Federation. Now, that doesn't make any sense at all from the point of view of German industry and the future of the German economy, but it makes absolute sense if you're sitting in Washington or in London. And that's, of course, what this is all about. It's provoking conflict in order to control the outcome.
I mean, back in 1990, with the fall of the Berlin Wall, something was signed called the 2+4 agreement between the Russian Federation, as it was at the time, Russia, effectively, and NATO. And as part of that agreement, they said that there would be no NATO troops be allowed into East Germany, only German troops. And yet that agreement has been just simply torn up. They've now got NATO troops, including all sorts of different forces personnel in East Germany. So what would you say?
And not only in East Germany, in Poland and the Baltic states as well,
that's
as we've just pointed out.
That's right. So there does seem to have been a roll forward of NATO right up to the border of Russia, including this missile defence screen, which has now been installed in Romania and is now being built in Poland, right on the Russian doorstep. Now, this is getting us very close to the whole situation which happened in 1962 with the Cuban Missile Crisis, where the Russians objected to having these possible nuclear weapons right on their doorstep.
Well,
American nuclear weapons.
Yeah, in Turkey.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of miles away from America, right next to Russia.
Yeah. I think the only thing that's keeping the lid on all of this is that the Russian general staff are very rational and have prepared very thoroughly for this situation. There is no way in any shape or form that they are going to win a fight against the Russian armed forces on Russian territory. And the Russians have no intention of leaving their territory. So all they've got to do is sit tight. And even these missile defence were very provocative, because the purpose of having these missile defences in Romania and elsewhere would be to knock out Russian leadership with a first strike, which prevents a second strike from taking place. So they're not defensive at all, they're offensive. But the Russians are pretty calm about this, because mutually assured destruction hasn't disappeared. They've got submarines out there, which, just as we have, which can incinerate Britain and the United States if Russia is attacked. So the good news is that the Russian general staff are well prepared and are very sensible about the situation. They're very annoyed at being provoked, but they're not going to be provoked. So a lot of this is silly. Steinmeier, the German foreign minister, has made exactly this point. He's at the summit, and he's from inside the NATO summit saying, look, this is silly. We can't go around kicking sand in the Russians' eyes. It's pointless.
Manfred Petrich was saying last week, Martin, that actually Europe is a major target for nuclear strikes by the Russians now, because of all the nuclear weapons which the Americans have in Europe. And he was also saying that the whole purpose of NATO now has nothing to do with defence, but it's in order to stop Germany and Russia making any alliances at all.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's why it probably won't come to an all-out war, because what the purpose of all of this is to prevent friendly relations between the Russian Federation and Germany in particular. And, of course, that has been achieved. And the Russian economy is the eighth largest in the world, and we are, our policy, as we speak, is to bankrupt the Russian economy. That's the policy of our government. It's also the policy of some members of the Labour Party, good grief to say. It's absolutely bonkers. If we were to bankrupt the Russian economy, as in 1998 the Russian economy was bankrupted, that led to the collapse of long-term capital management in Wall Street and nearly brought on the 2008 crash 10 years early. So if we were to be successful in crashing the Russian economy, we're not being successful because they've got other options and they're taking them. But were we to be successful in that lunatic goal, we would just be dragging ourselves down into the abyss, because Russia would default on its debts, which would crash Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank's going to crash anyway, because it's on the ropes. It's the most exposed bank for derivatives in the whole world. I think all of the insiders in the markets are looking at it, and I'm afraid all of this saber rattling, and of course the NATO exercise in Baltics has been called flashing saber, just so that the Russians get the message: we're flashing our sabres at you. All of this stuff is extremely dangerous for the financial markets. Absolutely bonkers, but here we are.
Now, it's air show weekend, isn't it? We've got the Farnborough Air Show, and I think it's the Air Tattoo at Fairford 2. I noticed a Royal Puff piece on the BBC with some BBC reporter, some young chap, stood next to one of these new F-35 fighters, which are called the Joint Strike Fighter. No mention of the fact that this Joint Strike Fighter is plagued by design flaws and cost overruns. These things are extremely expensive. Martin, they cost £70 million each, and yet the problem is it only flies in good weather. Computers that run it lack the software they need for combat. No one can say for certain when the planes will actually work as advertised. There's some key problems include the fuel tank design, software delays, no protection from lightning strikes, problem carrying out attacks at certain angles, display issues in the computer rigged pilot's helmet, and the unreliable ejector seats, amongst other things. Also, the cracks have been found in the wings of these things, and they cost £70 million each.
Well, the military-industrial complex in the West is not designed to produce effective military kit. It's a great big machine for spending money for the benefit of the corporations that supply the military. And so this is why you've got to have a Russian threat and a Chinese threat, because without a Russian threat and a Chinese threat, there'd be no reason to spend good money after bad producing this kind of third-rate kit. And incidentally, if it did come to conflict, I suspect that the nationalised Russian defence industry will show what it's worth, because they every ruble they spend is very carefully spent, and as we've seen in Syria, the West has been rather shocked by the efficiency of their kit, and that's because nobody makes a private profit on the production of that kit. When the Russian government decides to buy a piece of kit, an aircraft or any other piece of kit, it thinks very carefully about what it wants to spend, because there's no private profit to be made on spending it. So it really is a government decision, and that should be the same. That should be true in the West, but it isn't. In actual fact, jobs in Bristol, for example, at Rolls Royce, depend upon spending the money. So you spend the money because you want the jobs and you want to make the profit. And it's not really about whether you even need the kit.
Well, maybe
you don't need the kit.
Maybe Rolls Royce should be making the engines for this thing, because it's not just the media's word we've got to take for it. Last April, the Government Accountability Office in the US, which works for Congress, said the F-35's engine reliability is poor and has a long way to go to meet program goals. Also, they said, cost and affordability challenges remain. Now, what's happened is the US government has cancelled a bunch of orders for the F-35, which have been picked up by the British government.
Oh, well, there we are performing our useful role of putting the British taxpayer on the hook for the things that even the American taxpayer doesn't want to buy. Hooray for our independence, eh?
We got a kind of a cheery contribution to Prime Minister's questions this week on the Farnborough Air Show.
Gerald Howarth.
Mr. Speaker, further to my honourable friend from Worcester's question about UKTI, may I remind the Prime Minister that next Monday the greatest air show in the world takes place Farnborough in my constituency, to which all honourable and right honourable members are expected to attend. And may I remind my right honourable friend that last time, 2 years ago, deals worth $201 billion were signed at the Farnborough Air Show. May I therefore prevail on my right honourable friend, who may have just a little bit more time in his hands, to come and open the show on Monday and encourage all other ministers to attend.
Prime Minister!
I think I'm one of the first Prime Ministers in a while to attend the Farnborough Air Show, and I'm very happy to announce that I will be going back there this year, because I think it's very important. We have, I think, the second largest aerospace industry in the world after the United States, and it is a brilliant moment to showcase that industry to the rest of the world and to clinch some important export deals, both in the military and in the civilian space. And I would always do everything I can, whether in this job or in future, to help support British industry in that way.
$201 billion worth of deals, but this isn't really about civil aviation, certainly for Britain, Martin, is it? Almost all of this is military. Even Airbus, of course, is not actually British. It's a joint foreign-owned company, so even, you know, some of the Airbus work that goes on in Britain, is the profits are not actually made here anymore at all.
Well, that's right. And of course, what we're really talking about here is some people in Britain are going to make money selling aircraft to Saudi Arabia, for example, which will then be used to kill children in Yemen the following week after we've sold the aircraft to them. And of course, people don't draw any conclusions from this about the fact that we're creating terrorism and ill feeling towards us around the world. Oh no, surely not. I mean, we just made $201 billion last year from selling weapons of war to the most repressive regimes on the planet, who are our allies, and we're proud of it, and the Prime Minister wants to go along and show his face. Of course, that means that they are basically showing their bloody hands.
The only civilian aviation really that's manufactured in Britain anymore is something called the Britain Norman Islander on the Isle of Wight, a little sort of commuter prop engine plane, which is really the only vestige that's left of Britain's civil air aviation industry.
Well, that's right. I mean, the attempt to present this as an aerospace jamboree, it's a military aircraft jamboree, in which we do indeed lead the world. And of course, we talk about this as if it's an industry. All these military aircraft are sold to governments around the world who buy it with taxpayer money. So we're not talking about building a better widget to sell to consumers. We're talking about persuading governments like those of Saudi Arabia, who've got more money than sense, to buy our kit so that we can carry on making money on that kit, so that certain people can make money on the deals. And that's why we have to have war in Yemen, why we have to have war in Ukraine, why we have to have war in Syria, because we like war. War is what makes us money. And that's... Whenever the conflict gets ramped up, the shares of Raytheon, Lockheed, and all these others go up, and that's what it's all about. But of course, it's not really very effective from a war fighting point of view. As I pointed out a minute ago, the Russian nationalised defence industry will thrash us if it comes to a straight fight, because we spend an awful lot of money on rubbish.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com. And leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Now, the Chilcot Report, International Criminal Court, Martin, says it will not investigate Tony Blair, but it might prosecute the soldiers. And it said this before. This is on Sunday the 3rd, last Sunday, the International Criminal Court made it public that there's no chance that Tony Blair is coming anywhere near the place.
Well, I mean, the Chilcot Report is like a curate's egg. It's good in parts, isn't it? Certain aspects of what have been said in the sort of establishment ease in which the report is written have been revealing, in the sense that, you know, they're stating the obvious, really, but at least we've got an official statement of the obvious. Now, underlying all of this, of course, is the fact that this is, there weren't mistakes made. It wasn't a mistake. It was a crime. It was a preconceived, premeditated crime.
Now, Lord Stoddart mentioned this memo from get rather right away from Blair to Bush in the bombshell document, which you can find online. There's smoking gun emails. I think that's probably one of the headlines to look for, and I'll put it up on our webpage at thisweek.org.uk. In the bombshell document, headed "Secret Memorandum for the President," Colin Powell tells Bush that Blair will be with us on military action. It adds that Blair was preparing to act as a spin doctor for George Bush, who is told the UK will follow our lead.
What's been established here is that Blair agreed to go to war with Bush whilst he was trying to tell Parliament that he was looking for a second resolution from the United Nations. In other words, he misled Parliament. And Alex Salmond, I believe, is going to bring forward an impeachment motion in the House of Commons against Blair on that basis, which could, in theory, lead to him being imprisoned. Although I don't think there's been an impeachment motion in the House of Commons since the 1800s.
Peter O'Bourne in the Daily Mail has been doing some excellent work on this, and he's explained that there was the Cabinet Secretary of the time, whose name is not, I can't see immediately, oh that's right, Jeremy Hayward, was having these kind of informal meetings, like round a coffee table, which were not minuted, with Tony Blair, in order to try and steer the war through.
Well, exactly, we were talking earlier about cabinet government and so on. That's the whole point about cabinet government, is that there are minutes, and they can eventually be read. But if you don't take any minutes in these meetings, then of course the decisions are not really accountable decisions, are they?
Back in 2003, it was the task of Cabinet Secretary Richard, now Lord Wilson, to ensure that the traditional standards of government were maintained, yet he was frozen out by Blair's inner team of cronies. These included the former Daily Mirror journalist Alistair Campbell, ex-diplomat Jonathan Powell, and Angie Hunter, an old childhood friend of the Prime Minister. Well, now, this sounds like a war which was almost cooked up down the pub.
Yes, it was actually cooked up in the United States of America. And what these people did was they were given instructions by the United States of America and they took them. Catherine Gunn, who was the GCHQ whistleblower, was in the Guardian today saying, well, we were sent an email by the National Security Agency in the United States saying, we want you to spy on all members of the United Nations, and if you can who are coming to the UN in New York, so that if you can find anything out that might be useful to us in trying to get our war, could you please tell us? And she was actually outraged, saying, well, you know, why are the US National Security Agency giving us instructions to spy illegally on political leaders coming to the UN? And, that's the point at which she blew the whistle and leaked the email. The fact is that the war in Iraq was decided long before 9/11. And 9/11 was actually part of the psychological warfare preparation for the war in Iraq. And I'm afraid even the most radical mainstream Labour politicians still don't get this.
Well, we heard from Admiral Lord West, really from the horse's mouth, from one of the top military people, that this was being cooked up a year before it ever happened, back in the middle of 2002. I was quite amazed, I suppose not so amazed nowadays, to see that the build-up Bilderberg meeting in 2002, which happened in the US at Chantilly, very close to CIA headquarters. There was a journalist who I knew at the time, who's died now, is James Tucker. He wrote an article called "Bilderberg Are Plotting to Bushwhack Iraq," and he published that on the 7th of April 2002. And he was saying that these were the leaks that had been coming out of the people who were attending that Bilderberg conference over near CIA headquarters.
General Wesley Clark in the United States, who's a pretty hawkish character, but he's on the record as saying, well, I was told after 9/11 that we were going to invade seven countries, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya.
In five years.
And we've pretty much stuck to the schedule as proposed.
So this is the project...
Apart from the fact that every time they invade somewhere, they get their backsides kicked, and therefore they get slightly disturbed from the next madcap scheme.
The project for the new American century, effectively, the neocons in the US.
Yeah. Well, that's right, and I think the Russian general staff are pretty clear about what they're up against. General Ivashov, who's in command of the Russian armed forces on 9/11, is on the record as saying, well, we know what happened there. That was an inside job, and the purpose of that was so that you could start a war in the Middle East and against all these other countries, and the ultimate goal, target of all of this is us and the Chinese. But you may have fooled your own public, you may have fooled your own low-level military, but you're not going to fool us. It's our job to know what you do, and we do know what you do. And you are aggressive chancers.
Well, you're talking about...
And they are.
You're talking about the impeachment of Blair. This has been in one of these news reports this week about this. Triggering the process apparently requires an MP simply to propose a motion and support evidence as part of a document called the Article of Impeachment. If the impeachment attempt is approved by MPs, the defendant is delivered to Black Rod ahead of a trial. So in a way, it's the House of Commons being used as a kind of court of law.
Yeah.
A simple majority is required to convict, at which point a sentence can be passed. Last year, current Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn said the former Prime Minister could be made to stand trial for war crimes, saying that he thought the Iraq war was an illegal one and that Mr Blair has to explain that. He added, "We went into a war that was a catastrophe that was illegal, that cost us a lot of money and cost a lot of lives. The consequences are still being played out with migrant deaths in the Mediterranean and refugees all over the region. It's believed that 2.6 million word report due to be published in July, that's just been published, that's Chilcot, will not make any judgments on the legality of the war." But Martin, the International Criminal Court are saying that they won't try Tony Blair, but the House of Commons possibly could.
Yes, and don't forget the International Criminal Court is a very flawed institution. It's set up really only to prosecute people that the West doesn't like. And it's not really an independent court. In any case, the Americans haven't signed up for the International Criminal Court because they know if they did, their people would have to stand
trial. No, but
the
British have, and Tony Blair possibly has.
Well, indeed. So if there was an impeachment proceedings in the House of Commons, that could lead to him, you know, the punishment being him being
but
sent
what,
to the Hague.
Well, the effect of all of this is really damning for morale of the army. They're basically doing an illegal war, which has been more of a disaster than if they had just stayed at home, shall we say, just sitting in deck chairs.
Well, the British military have allowed itself to become a mercenary force for the neocons in the United States.
Well,
of America.
Hang on a minute, because actually the military have surely done the right thing here. If the democratically elected government tell them to go to war somewhere, they should do it. They shouldn't say, oh, we don't fancy this
well,
war.
Well, no. I did mention this in the first hour, and I cannot remember the name of the head of the armed forces at the time. It was an Admiral Sir Michael Boyce. I've remembered now. Sir Michael Boyce. He was interviewed by Paxman about all of this, and he said, well, I insisted that the Prime Minister came up with a piece of paper that said that the war was legal. And then Paxman said to him, well, you knew that that wasn't a really legal statement. He said, yes, but the point of that was that he's given me a piece of paper that says it's legal. That means he's to blame if it's not legal.
This
not
legal
me.
Piece of paper, I mean, it's a bit of a joke, really, isn't it, that something hinges
Indeed.
On that. But it was written by Lord Goldsmith at the time, very, very controversially, and also allegedly edited by Lord Falconer, who's one of the people who's just resigned from Jeremy Corbyn's cabinet, cabinet.
And his deputy, who's Elizabeth somebody, I can't remember the name, she resigned because he said this isn't legal. Now, what Paxman said to Sir Michael Boyce was, well, you knew that it wasn't a really legal document, and therefore, you know, you shouldn't have agreed with it. He said, yes, but the point is that Blair would go to the Hague and not me. Now, I would argue that it was Admiral Sir Michael Boyce's duty as the head of the British Armed Forces to say, unless you can give me a legal justification for this war, we're not going to do it. Because in actual fact, the Nuremberg principle is absolutely clear. You are absolutely forbidden to obey illegal orders. And all modern training for officers includes the Geneva Convention, Nuremberg principles, etc. So in actual fact, by agreeing to go to war on the basis of a document that wasn't a legal document, in actual fact, I don't think the soldiers do let themselves off. So Michael Boyce should have resigned at that point and refused to do what Blair was asking him to do. That was his duty as the commander of Britain's armed forces. He didn't do it. He went away for a nice retirement and no doubt a big pension at our expense. But lots of other people didn't come home.
Martin, some people are saying that this is actually part of a much bigger plan, something called the Yinon Plan, which is from 1982. An Israeli general decided that he wanted the Middle East balkanized.
Yes, I mean, there's a congruence between the desire to capture resources of the project from the New American Century in the US, you know, the City of London and Wall Street and all these people, the military-industrial complex, and the particular geopolitical needs of the Israeli state. They want to create war and conflict within the countries around them so that they can rule the roost, basically. And if you think back to apartheid South Africa, bad as it was inside South Africa, the real criminality of the apartheid regime was the wrecking of Mozambique and Angola through interference by South African and Western subversive forces, which led to the deaths of millions. And of course, the destruction of the Middle East by the Israelis, working in tandem with the Americans and the British, is, I mean, and don't forget, this is part of the world where half the population is under 25. We are creating a time bomb of bitterness and resentment towards us. And I hope for, if any of those people, that's why we demonstrated, try and show those people we're not going along with this. We're being dragged kicking and screaming. And I think people in the Middle East appreciated that.
Yeah, Lord Faulkner was on BBC's Question Time last night, and I do sometimes despair of the BBC with all the massive resources that they've got, that they didn't put the question to him about why did you alter the legal advice to make it look as if there was a proper case for war. Anyway, he was defending Tony Blair's decision to say, well, actually, he thought that removing Saddam Hussein was the right thing to do, and he got an absolute pasting from the audience at Question Time. But ultimately, there has been no kind of real legal decision about anybody that's been involved in these massive amount of deaths and this appalling military intervention. Ultimately, though, I talked about this Yinon plan. What do you think is the chance that actually what we're getting is we're getting people acting to an Israeli general's orders rather than to anything to do with democracy?
Well, the Israelis have their own agenda. So they, of course, have tried to provoke the Western forces into conflicts to say for their own purposes. So in the 1950s, in the Lavon affair, bombs went off outside British and American consulates and so on in Egypt, which were blamed on Islamic extremists in order to try and make, you know, the Egyptian government persona non grata with the Western powers. The Egyptian police captured the perpetrators. They were Israeli agents. And that the Israelis have always operated in that way. They go around creating conflict in order to drag the bigger powers, the Western powers in particular, into sorting out their problems for them. They wanted Saddam Hussein taken down, and the Americans and the British, not the French and the Germans, obliged. But of course, there were other forces at work who wanted, it's not, the Israelis don't determine everything to do with Western policy. It's an alliance, the real axis of evil, which is the right wing in Israel, the United States and Britain, in which I include Tony Blair.
It certainly seems to benefit the state of Israel having a kind of chaotic Middle East around it, doesn't it? But we've just seen, I mean, obviously there's a lot of accusations, fingers pointing at the Israeli government, saying what you're doing to the Palestinians is a form of apartheid, which is every bit as bad as what South Africa was doing in the 1980s. And that was overturned. That was a successful movement to boycott South Africa. There is also a building movement to boycott Israel, and as a result of that seen as a threat by the Israeli government, by people like Netanyahu, rather than dealing with the racism within their own country and within their own government, what they're doing is actually is this week on a charm offensive going all around Africa, Netanyahu trying to charm the African leaders to voting pro-Israel at the United Nations.
Yes, and he's got he's giving these various dictators in Africa, which many of which are supported by our own government, various incentives to support him. Of course, just as I made the point earlier, the real crimes of the apartheid regime were not in South Africa itself. They were in the countries surrounding South Africa, which were completely devastated. Mozambique and Angola have still not recovered from the devastation inflicted on them by the apartheid regime in that era. And of course, the Western intelligence services were right in there with them. MI6 and CIA in the forefront, supporting Savimbi in UNITA in Angola and RENAMO in Mozambique.
Back in 2003, one of the really principal people who resigned from Tony Blair's cabinet was Robin Kirk, and it wouldn't be complete talking about Iraq without hearing from him.
I applaud the heroic efforts the Prime Minister has made in trying to secure a second resolution. But the very intensity of those attempts underlines how important it was to succeed. Now that those attempts have failed, we cannot now pretend that getting a second resolution was of no importance. Yeah, yeah. France has been at the receiving end of bucket loads of commentary in recent days. It is not France alone that wants more time for inspections. Germany wants more time for inspections. Russia wants more time for inspections. Indeed, at no time have we signed up even the minimum necessary to carry a second resolution. We delude ourselves if we think that the degree of international hostility is all the result of President Chirac. The reality is that Britain is being asked to embark on a war without agreement in any of the international bodies of which we are a leading partner. Not NATO, not the European Union, and now not the Security Council. To end up in such diplomatic weakness is a serious reverse. Only a year ago, we and the United States were part of a coalition against terrorism which was wider and more diverse than I would ever imagine would be possible. History will be astonished at the diplomatic miscalculations that led so quickly to the disintegration of that powerful coalition.
That's the voice of Robin Cook, the very honourable Foreign Secretary who resigned in the run-up to the invasion, illegal invasion of Iraq. Martin, he subsequently died, didn't he? But also, he just before he died, in July the 8th, 2005, wrote a Guardian article where he said the struggle against terrorism cannot be won by military means.
Yes, and he also pointed out that Al-Qaeda was originally, it means the base, and it was originally a database, a hard drive held in the capital of Jordan, Amman, by Western intelligence services of all the jihadi extremists from Libya and elsewhere who'd been armed and trained and infiltrated into Afghanistan by our intelligence services and special forces. And of course that whole Operation Cyclone, as it was called, the biggest undercover operation in history, was funded through the selling of heroin on the streets of Bristol and other major cities in the Western world. All of that is history, indisputable history, but we still talk as if we are whiter than white and we occasionally make mistakes, but in general we're trying to do the right thing. That is simply wrong. We are the criminals that we claim other people to be.
Bin Laden was, Robin Cook says, though, a product of a monumental miscalculation by Western security agencies. Throughout the 1980s, he was armed by the CIA and funded by the Saudis to wage jihad against the Russian occupation of Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda, literally the database, was originally the computer file of the thousands of mujahideen who were recruited and trained with help from the CIA to defeat the Russians. Inexplicably, and with disastrous consequences, it never appears to have occurred to Washington that once Russia was out of the way, Bin Laden's organisation would turn its attentions to the West. So, fascinating bit of insight from Robin Cook there just a few days before he died.
Yeah, but it's also, to my mind, a limited hangout. Al-Qaeda remained a creature of
remember,
the West.
Remember, this is 2000... Martin, just a minute, because remember, this is 2005. Bin Laden's kind of gone out of the picture. Al-Qaeda is almost being embraced by the Americans now.
Well, yes, in the last two or three years, the al-Nusra Front in Syria, we are begging, and the British and the Americans are begging the Russians not to bomb them because they are moderate rebels and we've armed and trained them. And that means chaps from Hereford, from the SAS, have been arming and training them. Not in Afghanistan in the 1980s, but in Jordan and Turkey. Turkey's our NATO ally, Jordan's our Middle East ally, the Saudis are our allies. We armed and trained ISIS and Al-Qaeda to try and overthrow the government of Bashar al-Assad. So not only have we learned no lessons from the 1980s, I would put it to you that virtually all of these jihadi groups are in fact still under the control of the Western intelligence services. They were under their control in the 1980s, they are still under their control now. The Saudis cannot move without the support of the British and the Americans. And the Israelis, of course, are very much in bed with the Saudis. And so when Jeremy Corbyn the other day said, we do not blame Muslims around the world for ISIS any more than we blame Jews around the world for the misbehaviour of Israel. And there were howls of outrage from the pro-Zionist
He didn't
lobby.
Actually say ISIS. He said groups like ISIS. Like ISIS. He was talking about, these jihadi groups.
Yes, so in other words, there was then howls of outrage from the Zionist lobby saying, how dare you compare the state of Israel with ISIS? ISIS and jihadi groups. But the fact is that the Israeli military, the British military, the Turkish military, the Qatari military, the Saudi military have all been supporting these jihadi terrorists. In actual fact, they've been coming into Israel to have operations, bullets removed, etc., and then been infiltrated back into Syria. So it's a perfectly legitimate point to make. And of course, what Cook is doing there is he's speaking within the mainstream, where you can't actually call a spade a spade. The fact is that virtually all jihadi terrorism, both internal within the Middle East and within our own countries, is still, to my mind, virtually entirely under the control of Western intelligence services. Not entirely, because these things are never completely fixed. But that's what we've seen in Syria over the last 3 years makes it absolutely clear.
Okay, one of the most important intelligence insiders in the run-up to the illegal invasion of Iraq is Susan Lindauer. She suffered a year in jail to keep her out of the way and was threatened even with being drugged to become a permanent zombie. Let's hear now from an interview which we'll be hearing in full at 12 noon next Tuesday here on the Dialect programme. Susan Lindauer had quite a lot to say, particularly about what she thought about Tony Blair, Jack Straw, and David Kelly.
In Britain, I would definitely point my finger at Tony Blair and Straw. Shameful for performances. I was so grievously offended that and furious that Tony Blair dared to blame the intelligence community on this. Mr. Chilcott is correct. There was a lot of good intelligence coming out of MI6. Good intelligence warning them exactly what was going to happen. The consequences were well anticipated, but Mr. Kelly, for example, is a good example of somebody who paid the ultimate price, who was suicided to keep him quiet, to protect Tony Blair. I'd blame Mr. Tony Blair for Mr. Kelly's death, frankly. And it was a disgraceful performance. These leaders who demanded the war, who forced our country into the most devastating conflict, which is continuing to burn and is going to continue to explode for the next 100 years. This is the turning point of history, in my opinion. The Iraq War is the turning point of history. And Tony Blair forced our country into war, our world into war, and then lacked the courage and integrity to take responsibility for his own decisions. And I know for a fact that some factions of British intelligence tried to warn them. And in intelligence game, it's always about factions. So some factions are in power, some are on the outs. But the British government, as you can see watching if you watch just the Labour Party and the Tories fight it out on the floor in Parliament, you have a healthy democracy, a healthy a community of voices that are chomping and loud, and they're noisy, and democracy is so exciting and so difficult because of those different voices. But I promise you, everyone was screaming for them to stop. There were a lot of voices, very smart people, saying exactly what Mr. Chilcott has said. They were treated abominably by Tony Blair. So if you want the responsibility of office, you'd better be ready to shoulder the responsibility of the job.
Susan Lindauer there, who was one of the back-channel negotiators in the run-up to the 2003 illegal invasion of Iraq. Martin, what she's saying there is pretty much, a lot of it is written in her book, Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 and Iraq. But she's saying there that actually some of the major channels, intelligence channels, were getting all the correct information.
Well, that's right. And I think I remember seeing George Joffe speak, who was Britain's top expert on Iraq, and the civil service insisted that he had half an hour with Tony Blair before he went to war in Iraq. And I saw him speak, and he said, well, I went along to this meeting, and in the half hour I had to speak with Blair, I explained the complexities of the situation, the Sunnis, the Shias, all the problems that would ensue. And Blair turned around to me at the end of the meeting and said, but he is evil, isn't he? Meaning Saddam Hussein. And this is the top expert on Iraq, was sent by the civil service to talk to Tony Blair, and all he wanted to know, but is Saddam evil? Yes, he is. That's all I need to know. Now,
Susan also had quite a lot to say about Colin Powell as well.
Colin Powell is a gentleman whom I despise. I put him into the same category as Tony Blair and Foreign Minister Straw. I visited him twice before his speech at the United Nations. I delivered him first the copies of the Iraqi peace option so that he would know what options were available. And the second visit, I communicated to him that the Iraqi exiles were fabricating wild lies, wildly inventing stories because they had no support inside Iraq. They desperately needed the United States to send soldiers to force their way into power because they would never have any chance of rising on their own. And so I said, we're being manipulated by the exiles because they have no natural constituency at home. They've been out of the country for 30, 40 years. Nobody knows them. All the Iraqi people know is that the exiles supported the sanctions. The sanctions are hated. The exiles are hated. They've got no future. And so they are fabricating information because they have no other way of getting back into Iraq. And I was dead on the mark accurate. Let me tell you what Colin Powell did. Colin Powell turned that information over to the FBI. When he decided to whitewash the blood and dirt off his cowardly uniform, on September 8th, 2005, he gave a powerful interview to a journalist named Barbara Walters, declaring that it was the mid-level people at the CIA who failed to speak up and warn him about the bad intelligence he was getting from Iraqi exiles. And except for the tiny little problem that I had done so, and he had turned my papers over to the FBI. That was on that broadcast on September 8th. On September 17th, I was declared, quote, not competent to stand trial. So I had been accused of being an Iraqi agent for opposing the Iraq war because they said it was traitorous. I was committing treason because I had spoken out against the Iraqi war. But I was demanding my right to due process. I was demanding a trial. So what they declared was that I was not competent to stand trial, not competent to assist my attorney. And on September 23rd, 2 weeks after Colin Powell's speech, I was summoned into court and ambushed, ordered to surrender to prison without a trial or a hearing. And on October 3rd, I did, in fact, surrender to prison on Carswell Air Force Base. So the whole thing in a space of less than a month, from September 8th to October 3rd, I am cleared out of the way so that Colin Powell can go out and give his grand tour of pouting and petulance, you know, declaring how bad the intelligence community was, that nobody came and told him, and it was our fault, it was never his fault, he's not responsible for this mess, don't blame me. And I was locked up in prison for a year.
So how did Susan cope a year in jail when she hadn't even had a trial?
It was the most terrifying experience of my life. And I'm not saying that anybody who goes to prison it's very unpleasant. Nobody wants to do that. Don't break the law. It's an awful experience. But my case was traumatizing because I was denied the right to a trial. What they wanted to do was to lock me up for 10 years in prison. They actually petitioned the court to do this. Lock me up for 10 years, declaring that I was not competent and therefore I should be denied the right to a hearing in case perhaps I could bring witnesses or prove evidence that my story was true. And while I would be locked up for 10 years, I would be put into a straitjacket and tied down and forcibly injected with drugs that would chemically lobotomize me so that my brain would be cooked. And I would be, until I was so wrecked and ruined and physically destroyed, that I would never be a threat. The truth of what I knew would never be a threat to anyone like Tony Blair or George Bush or Dick Cheney or Colin Powell. What scum. That's why I have to tell you, I admire Mr. Chilcott's report very much. And to me, it's personally significant. And the only thing I would add to it that he may not know, they may know this or they may not. They do know that MI6 possessed this information about the real good quality information about what would happen, and that it is not hindsight. Everyone talked about it during the period of time. The one thing that I would add is that while the official channel at the CIA did not share this, our warnings, did not share the peace option, did not share the fears and the catastrophic analysis, behind the scenes, the individual assets like myself, we did make sure you got it. So we were trying to be good allies to the British by making sure that even if it didn't go through official channels, we took this to the Labour Party. And we took this to Tony Blair's own, not his, I guess you call them a shadow cabinet. I don't know that these people were on his shadow cabinet. They may have been. Some of them may have been. But I was sending information all over Britain, all over the Parliament.
Susan Lindau there. She's the author of a book called Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 and Iraq. Knows a lot about Lockerbie too, Martin. She's also saying this has been devastating for the US morale in the military. Completely devastating.
Well, they haven't actually won the war since World War II. They've fought a lot and they've lost a lot. And that's because they picked the wrong wars in the wrong places.
She's saying there that the good information was supplied to MI6. We've seen today, or maybe this is going to be in tomorrow's Daily Mail, how MI6 fell under the spell of Number 10, writes Peter O'Bourne, while MI5 did its job. He explains how security agencies had vastly different ways of dealing with Blair before the Iraq War.
Well, as Susan Lindau pointed out, intelligence work is all about factions. I still think that it was a crime, not a mistake.
Okay, Martin, well, let's hope some of those people get some punishment and some justice for the hundreds of thousands of people that have suffered. And as Susan said, a kind of turning point of history in a negative direction. Terrible crime. Anyway, that's all for this week. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. And I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling.
This is Bristol.
Do please join us on the Politics Show at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
And on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you.